Hi, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Two U.S. presidents were born in Vermont, Calvin Coolidge and that other one, the guy with the impressive mutton-chop sideburns who was only ever elected to one political post in his entire life, vice president. And even then, he was a compromise pick for that slot at the 1880 Republican National Convention, where it took 36 ballots to choose James Garfield as the party's presidential nominee. That compromise pick for Veep was Chester A. Arthur. He gets very little notice anywhere in the country, even here in the state of his birth. Consider that when you go to the Calvin Coolidge Historic Site in Plymouth Notch, it includes a dozen buildings on 600 bucolic acres. It includes the President Coolidge Museum and Education Center, which costs $9 for adults to enter. The Chester A. Arthur birthplace is very small. It's a yellow building on a dirt road in East Fairfield where donations are appreciated, and a sign near the entrance calls it, quote, the home of Vermont's other president. Touring the home will not take you very long. Today, Chet gets his due thanks to Scott Greenberger, a longtime journalist and the author of the new biography, The Unexpected President, The Life and Times of Chester A. Arthur. He joins us from the studios of National Public Radio in Washington, D.C. Scott, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you very much for having me.
There are very few biographies written about Chester A. Arthur, and there are probably even fewer Americans who know who he is. So why, Scott Greenberger, why were you compelled to write about him?
I get that question a lot, actually. Well, I think, first of all, personally, the fact that he hasn't been written about was appealing to me. Very few people have been president of the United States, and he was one of them. And like many, if not all, the presidents, he has an interesting story. And I think his story is especially interesting, actually. And I think one of the reasons that he's so often forgotten is that he and we can talk about this a little later, but he ordered most of his papers to be burned. So it's made it difficult for historians to really delve into his life. But I think he actually has a fascinating story, and he lived at a time, the Gilded Age, with a lot of parallels to our own time.
What did you know about Arthur before you started on this book? And then what was the most interesting thing that you learned from your research?
Well, like many people, I knew about his facial hair. You mentioned his facial hair. It is very distinctive among the presidents. And I think if not for that facial hair, many Americans wouldn't remember him at all. I did not know much about Arthur at all coming to this project. But what I learned was that the most interesting thing about him is that he underwent this dramatic transformation, that before he was president, he was a New York machine politician and a product of the spoils system. And then as president, he surprised everybody and became a reformer and ended up being the president who reformed the civil service system. And I think that that personal story of redemption, of transformation, is what makes him so interesting.
Today's history lesson is on Chester A. Arthur, one of the two U.S. presidents born in Vermont. Listeners, what do you know or want to know about our 21st president? Did you even know he was one of our presidents? Don't be shy. Call with your questions now at 1-800-639-2211. That's 800-639-2211. Or you can post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Scott, what do we know about his early life in Vermont?
Well, what we know is that he was the son of a Baptist preacher who was known as Elder Arthur. His real name was William Arthur. And Elder Arthur was a vehement abolitionist, a very outspoken abolitionist at a time, the 1840s and 50s, when even in the North, it was not altogether acceptable to be an abolitionist. And as a result of his abolitionist beliefs. He ended up moving his family from church to church. He very often alienated the parishioners in a particular church by being a little too outspoken. And so even though Chester Arthur was born in Vermont, he spent a good part of his childhood in upstate New York as his father moved from church to church, from parish to parish.
Now, we have a couple questions about his birth. We'll see how you do with these. Damien emailed, "It's almost common knowledge that Chester was born in Waterville, Vermont, and that was made especially apparent when we received a grant to take local oral histories. Many of those interviewed said that the only midwives in the area were in Waterville, where Chester's dad had been pastor. As the story goes, dad was building the new home in Fairfield while mom, pregnant with Chester, remained in Waterville, eventually giving birth. Any truth to that?" And then Rich also posted, "Where did the rumor come from that Arthur was born across the border in Quebec? And is there solid proof that this is not the case?" So what do you know about his actual birthplace?
Well, there is a lot of mystery surrounding his actual birthplace. Many people talk about Chester Arthur, and his name did come up at the beginning of the so-called birther controversy with regard to former President Obama. And people talked about Arthur and his story as the original birther controversy. Arthur was born in Vermont and therefore was eligible to be president. The rumor that he was born in Canada came from political opponents when he ended up on the Republican ticket in 1880 by surprise, as I think you noted. Democrats spread the rumor that he had actually been born across the border. Part of that might have come from there was a Canadian connection. His father had immigrated first to Canada and later came across the border. So maybe that's where that rumor got started.
Now, eventually he moves to New York City. And if there was ever a person who was drawn to and belonged in New York City, it was Arthur. So explain what took him there and why he wanted to get to the city.
Well, like many people then and today, he felt like as a young man, if he really wanted to make his fortune, become a huge success in the world, that New York was the place to do it. Actually, there's some interesting letters at the Library of Congress that I read where he's writing back to his friends in upstate New York and saying, you know, "I'm very lonely here. I miss my friends and my family, but I know that if I really want to make something of myself, this is the place to do it." So he ended up in New York and thrived in New York. And I think his rigid upbringing as the son of Elder Arthur, he rebelled against that. You know, he had grown up in a rural environment, in a very strict religious environment, and he wanted to forge his own path. And New York certainly was the place to do it. This was New York in the middle of the 19th century, and it was starting to become the major city that we know today. There was a lot of money there, a lot of chances to make money. And that's where he wanted to be.
Now, he becomes a lawyer in New York City in 1855. He represented Elizabeth Jennings in a case that one could say was the Rosa Parks case of its time. So tell us about that.
Yeah, it was a very interesting case. When he came to New York, he got a job in a law firm, the law firm of a friend of his father's. This was the first major case that he was assigned to, as you note, it was very similar to the Rosa Parks case. The story of a woman who got on one of the streetcars in New York, an African American woman who got on a streetcar that was marked for white people only. Back then, the streetcar lines were private. There were several different companies, and this was one of the private lines. And she was late for church, was with a friend of hers, and despite the fact that this particular car had a notice that it was only for white passengers, she got on. There was a dispute with the conductor, which resulted in her getting physically tossed off of the streetcar, and she told her story It ended up actually in Frederick Douglass's newspaper, and the publicity surrounding this story was pretty extensive. And Jennings sued the streetcar company, and Arthur was the lead lawyer in the case, and he won the case. And it actually led to the desegregation of all the streetcars in New York City, and was considered to be such a momentous victory that the African American community in New York celebrated the anniversary of the decision for years afterwards. It was a big victory for Arthur.
Well, Scott, did that case and being raised by an abolitionist father inform his outlook on civil rights in any way?
It did. He ended up marrying a woman from Virginia, and whose family, most of them still lived in Virginia. And once the Civil War rolled around, they were Confederate sympathizers. His wife was a Confederate sympathizer, which made it things very uncomfortable for him during the war, because at that point he was serving as a quartermaster of the Union Army in New York. So he had those abolitionist leanings, but actually there is a story about him going to visit his wife's family in Virginia, and they had slaves. And he either set his abolitionist beliefs aside, was able to do that, or just didn't want to offend his in-laws. But they in their letters that they wrote after meeting him were very enthusiastic about him. So apparently he didn't make a big fuss about the household slaves. Later, as president, he started to return to a more public abolitionist stand. Not abolitionist, since slavery had been abolished, but he was very progressive on the issue of civil rights by the standards of the time. And when the Supreme Court struck down the Civil Rights Act of 1875, he actually urged Congress to pass another law that would withstand scrutiny. So I think he always had that inside him, but he buried it sometimes.
And let's make no mistake about this guy. He was – Chester A. Arthur was a big city machine politician. So how does he go from Fairfield, Vermont to a major cog in the New York City and New York State Republican Party?
Well, as I noted, he went to New York, became a lawyer, won that the case that we spoke about. And then shortly before the Civil War started, he had already begun to express an interest in politics, and he got a ceremonial position as part of sort of the honor guard surrounding the governor. And basically the job entailed wearing a nice uniform and looking good, and he was a very handsome guy, about 6'3", so he was perfect for the job. When the war started, that job that had been ceremonial very quickly turned serious, and he was put in charge and was actually promoted several times of helping to equip and house the troops, Civil War troops pouring into New York City, and to get them ready to fight. After the war, in the middle of the war, he served quite honorably. In the middle of the war, his patron, the governor, was defeated, and so he knew that in order to stay to remain in the Union Army, he would have to take a reduction in rank and responsibility. Didn't want to do that. So instead, he decided at this point he was married that it was time for him to make some serious money. And the way to do that in the New York of that era, or one way to do it, was through politics and political connections. And so he very soon after came under the sway of the Republican boss of the time, a very flamboyant guy named Roscoe Conkling, and he became one of Conkling's most trusted lieutenants, and eventually that relationship led to a job as collector of the Custom House in New York, which was the a huge federal office in New York that was responsible for collecting duties and taxes on the imports that came through New York. And that was a very powerful position in terms of doling out patronage. So he really became a crucial part of the New York machine, which was the most powerful Republican machine in the country.
But inside the machine and not an elected official. So how does this somewhat corrupt party hack go from that to landing on the Republican Party ticket as its vice presidential candidate at the 1880 convention?
It's really an amazing story. I think he was as surprised as anybody that it turned out this way. So in 1878, he was a collector of the Custom House and at this point was a wealthy man and had used his position there and his connections with Boss Tweed and others to make a good amount of money. The reform-minded Republican president at the time, Rutherford B. Hayes, fired Arthur as part of his attempt to clean up the Custom House and sort of fight back against the spoil system and the machine politicians. So Arthur went back to his law practice. He still was working with Conkling and helping him. And then at the 1880 convention, he and Conkling and other members of what was called the stalwart wing of the Republican Party were backing former President Grant for a third term. That Grant had served two terms, and then there was Hayes, and they wanted Grant to come back. And Grant had been very friendly to the machines, and so they wanted him back in the White House. It was a very dramatic convention, as you noted, 36 ballots. Finally, they agreed on a dark horse candidate, James Garfield, a congressman, and Conkling was enraged, and the Republicans knew that in order to win the election against the Democrats in the fall, they would need to win New York. New York was the most populous state in the Union. And so to placate Conkling, they offered the second spot on the ticket to one of his lieutenants, Chester Arthur. And nobody imagined that Chester Arthur would ever be president. James Garfield was a young and vigorous man. And some people said at the time, Arthur can do less damage as vice president than he could in many other jobs. So they were okay with it. The Republican ticket triumphed in the fall, and Arthur found himself vice president of the United States.
And Garfield gets shot. He lingers for a few months and then dies. That had a pretty profound effect on Chester Arthur.
It did. The Garfield, as you note, lingered throughout the summer of 1881. Actually, in the newspapers of the time, you can see people followed every twist and turn in his condition during that period of time. And Arthur was deeply affected by that, by the violence, by Garfield's suffering. And also, it should be noted, by the suggestion made in some newspapers that somehow he and Conkling had something to do with the assassination attempt, because Garfield, like Hayes, had promised to institute reforms to fight back against the machine politicians. And so when Garfield was shot by a disappointed office seeker named Charles Guiteau, who also was mentally ill but was nevertheless a guy who had expected a job as many others got for his help during the campaign, when he shot Garfield, he said, "I am a stalwart and Arthur will be president." So it made it sound like he was a guy who perhaps had conspired with Arthur and Conkling to remove Garfield from the scene. So I think seeing Garfield suffering, the suggestion that somehow he had something to do with it, both of those things helped to transform Chester Arthur. And then one final thing, which I talk about a lot in the book, is he at the end of Garfield's life in August, the end of August, 1881, Arthur received the first of what would be two dozen letters from a mysterious young woman in New York named Julia Sand. She had never met Arthur. Arthur had never met her. But she clearly was a close follower of politics and of his career. And she wrote him a letter urging him to be a better person, to return to the kind of person he had been as a young man when he helped to desegregate the New York City streetcars. Those letters, I think, had a profound effect on him. And the evidence is that he, at one point during his presidency, paid her a surprise visit to thank her for the letters. He followed a lot of her advice, very specific political advice in the letters. And also, when he died and ordered almost all of his papers to be burned because he was ashamed of the kind of person he had been before he was president. He ordered that those Julius Sand letters, those letters from his admirer in New York, that they be preserved, and they're still at the Library of Congress.
That is a fascinating part of your book that I've never heard about before. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. Let's take a call from Edward, who's calling from Montreal. Hi, Edward. Thanks for calling us today.
You're very welcome. It's my understanding that Chester Arthur oversaw the transition of the U.S. Navy from what was known as the old Navy to the modern Navy, and that after this was initiated, the U.S. Navy modernized and became the largest Navy in the world by the 1920s. How much does he deserve the credit for that, or is it just something that he signed that was put forward onto his desk?
Great question, Edward. Scott?
I think he deserves a lot of credit for that, actually. In the years following the Civil War, the U.S. Navy really fell into disrepair. This was a period of time when most Americans didn't envision a vigorous, active foreign policy for the United States. And the Navy, the ships in the Navy at that point were basically designed to patrol very, very close to American shores. There was – no one really had contemplated sending them much farther than that. But Chester Arthur recognized that if the United States was ever to be a world power, and also that for its economic growth, it would need a real Navy. And he and his naval secretary pushed very, very hard to modernize the Navy. It wasn't just a case of him signing the bill. He was very active in pushing for that. And by the end of his presidency, the United States had really started down the road to having a modern Navy. When he became president, almost all of the ships in the U.S. Navy were made of wood, and this was at a time when the European powers were beginning to build steel ships. But he oversaw and pushed for the construction of the first steel modern ships for the U.S. Navy, and that really set the U.S. on a course to be the naval power that it would become. So, yeah, I think he deserves a lot of credit for that. And along with civil service reform, I would say that that the naval piece of his record is the piece that he really deserves the most credit for.
And explain a little more about the civil service reform.
So civil service reform, as I mentioned, there was, up until this point, a widespread belief that that if you worked for a political party and that political party gained power, that you were owed a job in the federal government. So what that meant in practical terms was that almost nobody in the federal government was actually qualified for the job they were supposed to do. It was just people who had helped out the party. And in fact, they were expected once they got the jobs to continue to help the party by providing what were euphemistically called voluntary assessments. They were anything but voluntary. So these were mandatory campaign contributions that people had to make in order to keep their jobs. Now, Arthur was a product of this system. As I noted, when he was collector of the Custom House, that was the largest federal office. And basically, his main responsibility was to provide jobs to people who were loyal to the Republican machine in order to perpetuate the machine, to keep it in power. But when Garfield was shot by a guy who, at least by his own admission, described his motive for the shooting as that he had been denied an office, he decided in his very first annual message, which was what they used to call the State of the Union address, that he would advocate civil service reform. Now, it didn't happen right away, but it did happen in his second year in office when Congress finally did pass civil service reform. And it's hard to imagine for us now, but this was a huge issue at the time. This had split the Republican Party. People who believed in civil service reform and that people should be hired based on their qualifications or exams, they really thought that American democracy depended on this, that we would not be able to continue as democracy if the federal government was just filled with people who were, in essence, party hacks. And I think taking a longer view, it's hard to imagine that we would have had the progressivism of Teddy Roosevelt and the presence that came after him and the more activist federal government without a federal government that was actually filled with people who knew what they were doing. So it was a huge shift, a huge change.
We had this written in by Ed. He said, we recently found an 1888 edition of the Boston Herald that mentions President Arthur. The pages are full of stories about strikes and labor struggle. How did President Arthur view the labor movement?
Well, he was president from 1881 to 1885, and he died shortly after leaving office in 1886. So there may have been references to Arthur in there, but he was not alive at that point in 1888. That was just starting. I mean, he did the Gilded Age, and this is one of the reasons I think it's a fascinating period, is there was a lot of concern for the first time in our history about the rise of big corporations, the rise of extraordinarily wealthy individuals, Vanderbilt and Jay Gould. You know, many of these people had made their fortunes on the railroads. And as these corporations grew and these wealthy individuals became incredibly wealthy, there was more and more connections between the government and private industry. And this was sort of wrapped up in civil service reform as well, because there was a lot of concern, as there is today, about the influence of big money in politics. So that you didn't yet have the kind of labor strife that you would have later on, the rise of the unions and strikes. So he didn't really have to deal with that. So it's hard to say where he would have been on that. But he did, in advocating for civil service reform, he did, in a sense, take action to curb the influence of big money in politics and of large corporations.
Let's go back to our phones. Laura is calling from Bradford. Laura, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Yeah, I wanted to say, first of all, I am related to him about six generations back. He's an uncle of mine. And years ago, I wrote for a newsletter, and my editor had told me that he never got credit for ending some conflict, I thought he said, with Russia and China, but I was never able to find anything about that, and I'm just wondering if you know what he was referring to.
No, I'm not sure. With Russia and China, I'm not sure about that. I mean, the Chinese connection with Chester Arthur is one that's a little less flattering, although it's not as simple as people portray it. This is the Chinese Exclusion Act, which has come up recently and pointed to as the first time that the U.S. restricted immigration. And that's true, and Arthur did sign that bill. But what is often forgotten is that couple things. First, he vetoed a bill that would have been even harsher and more restrictive. And then second, he had very little chance of stopping that bill anyway. There was tremendous support for limiting immigration from China, especially in the western part of the country, because of a fear, the stated fear that that Chinese immigrants were taking the jobs of native-born Americans. So again, another parallel between then and now, concerns over immigration. But so that's the Chester Arthur and China relationship I'm aware of. I'm not sure exactly what the Russia-China thing would be.
Yep. And let's talk to Ed, who's calling from Addison. Ed, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
In college in Schenectady, New York, where Arthur went to school, and every day we'd pass his statue. And I guess I was just wondering, because he was sort of a joke there too, to a certain extent. I'm just wondering what the effect, if you had done any research on the effect of his education at Union, was on him.
Great question, Ed. Scott?
He went to Union College, really thrived there. I talk about that in the book. Was very popular there. Was active in debate and gave a speech like many of his classmates did when he graduated. I think it's interesting that the caller said that he was sort of considered to be a bit of a joke even at his alma mater. And I think it's unfair. I think the combination of him burning his papers and the fact that he was president during this period that's a little fuzzy in the minds of most Americans, this period that's I think many of us in school, we learn about the Civil War, of course, a little bit about Reconstruction, and then it's a very quick fast forward to Teddy Roosevelt and then World War I. And I think all of that, maybe together with the facial hair, makes people dismiss him. But I mean, obviously, I wouldn't have written the book if I didn't think he had a very fascinating story. And I think he actually had some very significant accomplishments. And when he left office and then later when he died, people talked about him as if he were one of the better presidents we'd ever had. Even Mark Twain, who certainly was would never be accused of being too soft on politicians, said toward the end of his presidency that he couldn't imagine us having a better administration than the one of Chester Arthur. So I think he's a guy who deserves a second look.
I want to get back to something you mentioned a little bit earlier, Julia Sand, a woman who called herself Arthur's little dwarf. She wrote him a number of letters. So how often did she write, and in what areas was she trying to influence the president?
So she wrote him over a period of about 2 years of his presidency. So again, the first letter that she sent to him that we have, of course, these are the only 23 that we're aware of, arrived shortly before Garfield died. And then the last one was about 2 years later. And the letters are fascinating. Some of them are very, very long, but they're filled with specific political advice. So I mentioned the Chinese Exclusion Act, and she was very disappointed in him for not vetoing that again, and she told him so. She urged him to, for example, there was a bill called the River and Harbors Bill, which was sort of a perennial bill that came up, and much like today, it was supposed to be. It started out as a bill to fund nautical navigational improvements on inland rivers and waterways. But over time, it became a vehicle for congressmen to add all kinds of their own pet projects and even to enrich themselves. And he vetoed that bill and said, okay, that's enough. And that was at her urging. And she also urged him, as I mentioned earlier, to just be a better person. She reminded him that now that he was president, he would be judged by history. He could no longer just be the leader of a faction or a machine politician. He needed to be the leader of the whole country and had to bring the country together. The country was, not surprisingly, really shaken by Garfield's assassination. I mean, relatively. It hadn't been that long since Lincoln had been assassinated too, and so she told him that he had this great responsibility, and that sure it had been thrust upon him, but he needed to rise to the occasion. Also, as an aside, there's also a lot of funny stuff in there about she's urging him to take care of himself, mm-hmm. and she was worried that he wasn't healthy, that he should perhaps go for riding more often, but only if he lost a little weight, because otherwise it would be unfair to the horse. She worried about the horse and the fact that he was gaining some weight. So the letters are really, really interesting and entertaining to read.
Very forthright. And he was no William Howard Taft, but he did indeed love the good life, loved to eat and drink and smoke cigars, loved Cubans. Let's take another call. Jane is calling from East Fairfield. Hi, Jane. Thanks for calling us today.
Yes, hi. I do live in East Fairfield and not too far from the Chester Arthur Place site. And I actually work there every other weekend to help out with, the visitors who come. And first of all, I'd love to encourage people to come and visit us. It is a small site, but there's a lot to learn about Chester Arthur, which, Scott, you are doing a fantastic job. I have to say, I'm very, very impressed.
Oh, thank you.
My question for you has to do with the fact that while Chester Arthur was president, he did go to Yellowstone National Park, which at the time was the only national park. And my question was, I thought I had heard or read somewhere that he was responsible for making sure that the national park stayed as a national park, that there were people who didn't really think that the government should be supporting national parks. And so my question for you is that correct, or am I sort of not understanding the whole thing.
Scott, fact or fiction on the national parks question?
Well, I would say mostly fact. He actually, yes, he did visit Yellowstone Park. He also, in addition to loving food and drink and cigars, he loved to fish. And he took an extended trip through Yellowstone Park. And the reason that he did that at the invitation of people who wanted to preserve the park. There was at this point in history a lot of pressure from mining interests and logging interests and others to open up the park to that kind of activity. And people who wanted to protect the park felt like the best way to make the president understand just how beautiful it was and how important it was to preserve it would be to bring him out there. And that's what they did. So he and a succession of other presidents that came after him ended up preserving the park, obviously, because fortunately it is it's still there for us today in its pristine state. So I think he does deserve some credit for that because, as I say, there was a lot of pressure on Capitol Hill at that point, a lot of heavy lobbying going on from these interests that wanted to open it up to commercial activity.
With all his accomplishments and with the reviews he got upon leaving in 1885, why didn't the Republicans renominate him to run in 84?
That is a very good question. I think there are a couple of reasons for that. Number one, he had – even though he had called for civil service reform and was vigorously implementing civil service reform, reformers still didn't quite trust this guy who was a product of the machine. I mean, he really had been the epitome of the machine politician, and they just weren't completely sure about him.
Scott Greenberg is a longtime journalist and the author of the new biography, The Unexpected President, The Life and Times of Chester A. Arthur.